is the Grillion Report. The unusual, weird news, anomalies, exopolitics. It's Beyond the Fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grillion Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
And from hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth, live from the Grillion Bunker, welcome yet again to the one and only program known as the Grillion Report. I'm your host, Micah Hanks, along with Caleb Hanks and Tyler Pittman in a newly optimized, newly remodeled Grillion Bunker. Not much brighter than it ever has been, just about as much moss growing on the walls, but it sounds good, it feels great. We hope you guys are all feeling great out there just as well. Joining me, as mentioned, here in studio are the boys in the bunker, Mr. Caleb Hanks. How are you, Caleb?
I'm wonderful, Micah. How are you doing?
Magnificent, marvelous, marvelous indeed. And, of course, the Dark Cardinal of Mayhem himself, Mr. Tyler Pittman, joins us as always. Tyler, how are you?
Doing great. Good evening, everybody.
Eve to you. And Eve to all of you out there in Gradio Land. By the way, if you're listening live for the first time, I know there are a few people out there in the chat room who are. Welcome to the chat room. For the rest of you who are downloading online, be sure and check out GrailingReport.com each day, because in the right-hand column there on the main website, you'll see weekly, actually it's daily updated news every day of the week that appears there at GrailingReport.com. But we've also got links to the podcasts via Stitcher, iTunes, and also now on TuneIn just as well, a new feature that we've got for the fine folks out there who always support what we do and listen. It's going to be weird tonight. We're going to be breaking down the idiocy that occurs in the media. And I'm going to tell you there's an awful lot of it, because virtually everything that is discussed online by media agencies and outlets is twisted in some way. And it's all, of course, aimed at driving traffic to websites and whatnot, getting hits, clicks, and even monetizing sites in such a way. But we're going to break down how at times this can be rather harmful, and we're going to try and separate the proverbial wheat from the chaff in doing so. But first, let's get to a few things that are going on in the news, and we're going to be as, dare I say, as objective as we possibly can be. Scientists have now said that they've found a way of genetically modifying mosquitoes. You've been worried about GMOs? Well, these are GMO-skitos. And what they're doing is they're attempting to produce sperm that only creates males, offering a potential fresh approach to fighting and eventually eradicating a disease known as malaria from the planet. Now, researchers from Imperial College in London tested a genetic method that distorts the sex ratio of Anopheles gambia mosquitoes, the main transmitters of the malaria parasite, so that the female mosquitoes that bite and pass the disease to humans are simply no longer produced. In a study published in the journal Nature Communications, the team reported that in the first laboratory tests, the technique created a fully fertile mosquito strain that produced 95% male offspring. For the first time, according to Andrea Cristiani, who led the research at Imperial Department Life Sciences, she says that for the first time we have been able to inhibit the production of female offspring in the laboratory, and this provides a new means to eliminate the disease. But in essence, what we're talking about doing here is eliminating female mosquitoes from the population in order to do this. Now, a question. Is that ethical? We'd like to hear from you. If you would like to tell us what you think, you can also reach us in the chat room if you're listening live, but the rest of you out there who download the podcast each week, email us info@grillionreport.com. We'd like to hear from you. And speaking of emails, before we go much further, we'll get to a couple of emails really quickly, because there are a lot of new listeners, as I mentioned. I think that there are a lot of people who tune in, you know, fans of Jim Harold. They've been enjoying the Paranormal Report that he and I do every Friday, and they're coming over and they're finding their way down into the hollow earth. It's a long trek down here to the bunker, but we're seeing more and more of you these days. Andrew writes, I'm a relatively new fan. I got turned onto your stuff through Mysterious Universe, and I've been going through old episodes of the Grillion Report. It's great stuff. And it looks like you and your colleagues have tons of material in several different formats. I can't wait to check it all out. But I noticed that you keep referring to something that I don't know how to spell. Is it Heddle? 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 Some kind of horned monster, I think? I couldn't find a reference to it on your site, or through most general web searching, in fact. Is it a regional cryptid or something from ancient folklore? Either way, how do you spell it? And again, thanks for everything you do. We need to get more people taking this stuff seriously and putting in the hard work to cut through all the woo. Andrew from New York. Well, Andrew, first of all, welcome to the Grillion Report. And what you're asking about is something that is known as a Heddle. And this is kind of particular to Grillion lore. You see, we talk about how we broadcast from a bunker literally hundreds of miles beneath terra firma in the depths of the hollow earth. And I get emails actually pretty frequently from people saying, I mean, are you guys really in a cave underground? Now, I can neither confirm nor deny that I am, but part of the mythos of what we have created here with the Graylien Report, it's more than just a podcast, more than just a news show. What we actually are is a growing mythology of sorts. There are real people, real bodies, real news, very little BS when it comes to our interpretation and presentation of that news, or at least we like to think so. But from time to time, we like to incorporate this growing mythos that we surround ourselves with into this program, and I've always been fascinated with Hollow Earth mysteries. And in being fascinated with the Hollow Earth, it led me to a novel written a few years ago by a guy named Jeff Long called The Descent. Longtime Graylien listeners know I love this novel. There was a film rendition that was made pretty good, but I don't think it did really justice to the story like Jeff Long's novel. And in the novel, basically what happens is it is found that evolving parallel to humanity are these proto-humans that exist underground. And at one point that they were even a common ancestor of ours, that they may have even in ancient times taught us language. And it's a beautifully written novel that ties together the ideas of the Hollow Earth and the ideas of religion, spirituality, myth, folklore, all these kinds of things. And so I'm really fascinated with it. And I love the book. It's probably my all-time favorite novel because of the way it takes a Da Vinci Code kind of approach to Hollow Earth mysteries. Well, when we began to do our broadcast and we stumbled onto the bunker and had found this fantastic underground Cold War era broadcasting facility deep beneath the heart of the Appalachian Mountains, we began retrofitting it and, you know, preparing for what we knew would become a great thing, which you listen to each week called the Graylien Report. And Andrew, which in the future you'll be listening to each week, hopefully just as well. And as we went about our work, we would leave the bunker and take the 30-something minute elevator ride back up to the surface from time to time. When we'd get back the following evening and be preparing and doing our work, we'd notice that things had, well, maybe been moved around a little or something in the bunker. You know, this or that might have been misplaced. You know, a door had been left open. A desk drawer maybe was pulled open and left awry. So we didn't understand exactly what was happening. And we began to realize after some time that we weren't alone down here. Now, I'll just leave it at this. Measures were taken to ensure safety and stability, and so, of course, there's no danger that the Graylien boys are in when we do this broadcast, but we always have to be aware, because when you hang out in the Hollow Earth, there are a lot of weird things that can happen. But in essence, that should answer your question, and that's what Hales are and why we talk about them so much on this show. Yeah! Moving right along, Mark Gardner writes, my wife and I were vacationing at Atlantic Beach, North Carolina, on the end of the island, doing some fishing last Monday, and happened to look out and see this image. And he attaches an image. He says it was taken from a cell phone and doesn't really do justice compared to what we were seeing with our own eyes, but I figured who better to ask than the man himself, who's written on such things. Now, the time of day was around 5 in the afternoon, and we witnessed this as it was actually happening. What we see in this photograph, folks, is what it looks like a jet trail, but it's forming a perfect S in the sky. He says, we didn't notice it until halfway through the bottom part of the S, but watched it until it slowly dissipated. Now, I assume it was a rocket of some type, but the closest landmass facing in that direction is Bermuda, so I don't think it would have been anything that had been launched from land. We could see a light, but no object making this, and when it was at the top of the quote-unquote S that we saw, where you see the hook, it basically made a straight line horizontally to the left and then just vanished. Now, I've researched what I could on launch dates, but I couldn't find anything about June 2nd when we saw this. I was hoping someone else may have seen it. Any ideas? Thanks, and great podcasts, by the way. Mark and Tabitha Gardner. Well, Mark sent a fabulous photo of this, and it's actually a lot better than he alludes to there, and so thank you again for that, Mark. We'll have that posted at graylienreport.com. There's been a lot of talk about strange jet trails and things that have been seen, especially after we had an article that appeared at the website over the weekend, which shows a strange helical contrail. Now, if you haven't been to the site and seen this yet, I advise that you go and take a look. There's this helical contrail, and what we appear to be seeing is literally the twin trails that were produced by a jet of some variety. But something, whether it be an atmospheric phenomenon or something about the actual craft itself, causes these trails to twist around themselves like a double helix. And you think at first that what you're seeing is actually a cloud. So did the filmer, who was actually videoing this over New Zealand. But then you see the aircraft taking off in the distance away from and toward the horizon from where the videographer is standing. And so I have to say, it's obviously some kind of an aircraft, but it was very strange the kind of contrail this thing produced. And I have to mention, and it's a hot topic right now, you hear a lot about it, I have really mixed feelings about this, and it certainly falls into what we would call conspiracy theory talk, but people have been saying contrails. Others are saying chemtrails. Chemtrails, yeah. Well, I don't know what you think about chemtrails. Again, there have been conspiracy theories for years claiming that there are certain aircraft that literally crop dusters and sometimes more, commercial airliners and less what you'd consider to be conventional sources of strange stuff that's being put out into the atmosphere. But people have claimed for years that different varieties of aircraft are releasing things in the atmosphere. I don't know how I feel about that, though, guys. I mean, do you guys buy the whole chemtrail thing?
Yeah, I don't know.
Oh, my. I think there's some evidence that they're doing what's called geoengineering. As far as what they're spraying in the atmosphere, I couldn't say whether or not it's Big Mac ingredients or potentially biological altering chemicals.
Hmm. Startling.
I really don't care.
Startling. Startling, if anything else, it's startling commentary you guys are providing here. Now, I'll say this. You may have seen this story, by the way, about a doctor in Washington State. This is pretty startling, too. He has been accused. Well, he's apparently actually already been suspended. In the state of Seattle, he's an anesthesiologist who was accused of frequently engaging in sexually explicit text messages while performing surgeries. Boy, that's what you want to hear, is you're being put under by the anesthesiologist, and as you're going under, he's like, wow, look at this one. Take a look at this picture. A statement issued Monday by the state health department says that Dr. Arthur Zilberstein is accused by the commission of compromising patient safety by his, quote, preoccupation with sexual matters while he was on hospital duty. This occurred between April and August of last year. Now, in addition to the allegation of sexting, as it's become called in popular usage, during surgeries when he was the responsible anesthesiologist, the commission has also accused Zilberstein of improperly accessing medical records, imaging for sexual gratification, and for having sexual encounters at his workplace. Can you spell sicko? Unbelievable. I mean, it's just, it borders, guys, it borders truly on the patently absurd, if not bizarre. But, you know, I don't think anything could be more bizarre than this story that Tyler found just before we went to air. Police in China are investigating the curious incident of the dog, okay, that was found in daytime within a vehicle. A fraudster had used the dead mutt's body to try and fake his own death in a road crash. Now, get this. Apparently, it was a shaved St. Bernard. Officers say that the dead dog was all part of the scam by Ho Li to fake his death and escape to a new life with his lover. It happened in Jiaozin Township in Shandong Province, East China. According to local officials, 44-year-old Li bought a large St. Bernard dog that was on sale at a local market. And unfortunately, he killed the animal, then shaved the creature and wrapped the carcass, minus its paws and head, in his own clothes, destined to succeed. You know, I think just for killing the dog, this is what the guy gets. Anyway, in the clothes, he buried his ID, papers, his wallet, even cash, and placed the canine corpse on a road. It was, as he hoped, hit by several passing vehicles, including a lorry, and was badly mutilated. Now, I'm sure no one would have noticed that, well, there weren't hands, that there were paws, that the ears were extremely large. Probably, if anything, they'd been misshapen after being flattened and run over so many times, to the point that they merely looked like a dog, or at least so he hoped. What an idiot! What an idiot!
Are you sure this isn't viral marketing for the last Beethoven movie, Beethoven's Last Stand?
Oh, man. Gosh. Police found the man Li had complex relationships with women and suspected that the accident was a murder at first. However, when the body was checked, police discovered that the body was that of a dog and not a man.
Wait a second. This dog's got some kibbles and bits in his fur.
Yeah.
This man's tail is incredible.
Well, you know, Caleb, it wasn't the tail that clued them in, I'm afraid. But anyway, 4 days after the accident, police discovered that Li was opening a bank account in that locality, rushed there in time and arrested him. According to Li, who was married, he had a lover who was pregnant. He was too scared to admit that he wanted to leave, so instead of breaking away from his family and live with his lover, he tried to fake his own death. Unfortunately, he took the life of the St. Bernard. Folks at home, I have to advise you, if you're going to attempt to fake your own death,
don't shave a dead dog and try and present that as the corpse. It's not fooling anybody. When we come back, we're going to take a look at some things that have been going on in the media and how the media puts their weird spin on it, but from a Fortean perspective, of course. It is the Graylin Report with Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, and yours truly, the Mouth of the South. I am Micah Hanks. We'll be back right after this. Don't go away. In this article, this fella makes the case that UFO believers are all airheads, but the entire thing's based on the misunderstanding of what the term UFO means in the first place.
This is Micah Hanks.
I couldn't tell you if alien abductions actually occur. I couldn't tell you if UFOs are actually responsible for cattle mutilations. But as long as the media can treat this like a circus,
these subjects will never be addressed in a serious forum.
The Micah Hanks radio program.
When are people going to wake up?
On the Global Radio Alliance.
I'm telling you. The answers are out there, but you got to know the right place to look. And you have to present the information that you find in a credible, consistent manner.
Sundays at 8 p.m. Eastern, only on the Global Radio Alliance.
I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylin Report. Welcome back. As we're about to make our foray into what the media is telling you and why I think, well, a lot of it is bunk. And you'll see why shortly. I do want to remind you, if you enjoy this program and what you're hearing, check out Graylin X for a little bit more of the best from the bunker. And everything that comes from the bunker is what we like to call the best. But anyway, getting right to it. You know, at Paradigm Symposium last year in October, Red Pill Junkie and Adam and a lot of people who are probably in the chat room hanging out right now, and a lot of you who are out there listening, we were all there together, and we met for the first time. Well, some of you may have met him beforehand, but I know it was my first meeting with Dr. Robert Schock. Now, Dr. Robert Schock, of course, is considered by many to be an alternative historian. He is primarily a geologist, also with a background in geophysics. But Dr. Schock is interesting to me because he utilizes science to determine, a number of strange things that are kind of outside the typical paradigm. One of them is the assertion that the Sphinx is actually much older than conventional history has taught us. And furthermore, that the Sphinx may not actually have originally been a Sphinx, but had maybe been a very large lion. And that the head that is now on the Sphinx is not probably the original head that was on that large monument. There are a lot of things about ancient Egypt that I think have to be questioned, and I feel that after viewing Dr. Schock give lectures on this subject more than once, three times, because he went on the Ancient Alien cruise with me back in January as well. We got to spend a good bit of time together in Mexico, he and his wonderful wife Katie and I. And I'll tell you this, I think that I'm someone who tries to be very careful about interpreting what people pass off as science. You know, on the Paranormal Report, in fact, Jim Harold and I threw out the P word last week. Do either of you, by the way, know what the P word is?
I sure do.
What's that, Caleb?
Pomegranate.
No. Tyler, you want to give a guess?
Pervert.
No, that was the doctor in the last story. Pseudoscience. It's the P word that actually begins with an S. And we're going to be talking about that a little bit later in the program, too, because I want to get to basically the top ways that Carl Sagan had said that one could probably identify BS. Now, I think there are a lot of people, especially in the paranormal world and in Fortean circles, who have mixed feelings about Carl Sagan, because here this guy was the arch skeptic. But I think that he offered a lot that every person who seriously wants to understand what's going on with unexplained phenomena, they owe it to themselves to study Carl Sagan. You don't have to agree with everything that he says. I don't agree with everything that he said myself.
You know, he was a brilliant man, a brilliant cosmologist, you know, and a brilliant scientist. But I think that by the same token, he also was someone who had a very scientific attitude and a very conventional one when it came to the study of UFOs. And his knowledge of physics and the space and the cosmos, when applied to the study of UFOs, probably was not as data-oriented as maybe a UFO historian like Richard Dolan today. But he certainly was someone who was very scientific. And whether or not you agree with everything that he said, and I know that in his book, The Demon-Haunted World, he made some great points from a skeptical perspective on UFOs. That might not account for all the phenomena, but nonetheless, I think that he made some good points, and it's worthy of studying. Take your news from both sides. You know, Kayla and I were talking back before we went to air tonight, and I'd mentioned that we were reading an email from a popular commentator on paranormal phenomena who I will not name. And this individual is basically going over some things in an email that he had sent out. And one of the things he lists about and basically a presentation he's giving is why, and he is naming all these points, and he lists why this is not a scam. And I think, you know, it's really sad when somebody has to basically give you reasons why what they are saying is legitimate and why it should not be interpreted as being a scam. Now, this is a friend of mine, and so I don't want to call this person out, but I nonetheless think that, you know, that's a little sad, you know, when that ends up coming into question, whether a person is scamming you or not, and you being the presenter have to ask, you know, or assure people, don't worry, this isn't a scam. If there's one thing I've never been accused of, it's of having been someone who's trying to scam people for money or who's trying to scam people with information. And yet I do see that in the media, you see that an awful lot. People basically put certain twists on stories so that they can find a way to basically present this in a palpable way or in a way that is going to benefit them. I want to get back to this Egypt thing here in just a moment, but very first I will address one final thing. If there's anything people have ever gotten after me about, and this is what Caleb and I were talking about, it's that, well, they don't like the whole middle road skeptic attitude that I espouse. They say, you know, you don't seem to be brave enough to pick your own side. You won't be right or left. You know, you won't be a hard skeptic or a believer. You want to just make everybody happy. No, I think probably I make fewer people happy than I make them angry by trying to advocate this kind of a non-biased skepticism. Actually, I don't make that many people angry. If anything, the number of emails I get from people about this that express support and understanding for what I'm trying to convey is overwhelming. But the few that do get angry, they say, you know, you're just too whatever to call yourself a Republican or a Democrat, and you don't want to call yourself a skeptic, you know, but you don't want to call yourself a believer. You're just afraid you're going to make everybody mad. No, I think the thing is that you can't be a skeptic all the time any more than you can be a believer all the time. You have to be able to be flexible enough to be able to utilize your brain and your mind and your ability to apply logic and reason to determine case for case whatever has to be determined about a circumstance based on what logic and what actual data yields. And so if I've disagreed with Carl Sagan at times, it is because his skepticism toward the UFO subject is so skeptical that I think that he discounts certain available data. For example, when Jacques Vallée offered to present him with, you know, I think 10 of his best case studies, and in the end, Sagan, who initially had said, yes, I'll look at this dossier, but then when Vallée contacts him and says, you know, I have it prepared, how can I get it to you? At the last minute, Sagan basically kind of goes, well, you know, I haven't got time anymore. You know, I just can't be bothered with that. And I do think that there are brilliant minds like Carl Sagan who, in the scientific community, tend to become so beholden to their paradigm that when they are presented with facts that may be to the contrary of what they've been taught and believed, they will show a tendency to, well, I haven't got time for that. In fact, they're actually rejecting it. They're trying to keep it outside of the brain bubble that they have entered. Now, coming back to Egypt, Robert Schoch for years has been talking about the age of the Sphinx and the fact that he thinks that it was something else before it was what we commonly see as the Sphinx today. You'll see at the Graylian Report Daily News today that we had a story linked, and I think actually it's like the second story maybe. No, actually, I think it's the fourth. Okay, but it's titled Smithsonian Magazine Says This Wasn't Supposed to Be a Sphinx. Now, we have audio, and I love this because now we have Smithsonian Mag posting this link to this video, and listen what they're talking about.
When you stand and look at the Sphinx from this direction, the proportion's wrong. And yet the head of the Sphinx, when you look at it from this direction particularly, it's too small. The body is long, it's tall, and the head is quite out of proportion. For the ancient Egyptians to have got the proportions so wrong doesn't seem to make sense. They were masters at work in stone. There's something we must be missing with this.
There has to be another piece of the jigsaw.
And the answer lies in the stone itself.
We know for most of its life that the Sphinx has been buried up to the shoulders, the neck in sand. I've seen it other places at Giza that the sand tends to protect the rocks that are buried beneath it. The head's been exposed for almost the entire life of the Sphinx. It's been exposed to wind-blown sand, the effect of the sun. If anything, the head should be more degraded than the body, but we see the reverse. And for me, there's only one real explanation for that, and that's that the head has been recut.
You think?
At a later stage, whatever was there originally was retrimmed, reprofed to give us this pharaoh's head. The inescapable conclusion from that is that originally this wasn't a Sphinx at all. It started life as something different.
Cue the intense music as Optimus Prime storms down and crashes into the thing battling a Decepticon.
Wow.
I just love this. You know, if Robert Schock, if somebody, and you got to keep in mind, Robert Schock is a professor at Boston University. Okay? Dr. Robert Schock. He's not academic enough for a lot of the academics out there, though. And so if he's been saying this for 20 years, that doesn't matter. If he says that his study of the geophysics and the geology of the terrain around the Sphinx tells us things about this historic site that are contrary to what we've thought we've known based on scientific data that's been collected, in decades and even centuries past. And keep in mind, during a time where the tools available to us maybe didn't allow for as thorough an analysis in every instance as what we have available to us today. Folks, let me tell you something. As the technology improves, as our database and our knowledge base expands, as real scientists, what we have to accept is that our theories will change. And our fundamental ideas that we are dealing with and applying to what we're studying are going to differ at times. They will even appear to either refute or negate one another. And there are going to be instances where, as scientists, we will have to look at the old paradigm for what it is, which is just that, an old paradigm. And we'll have to realize, my God, maybe, just maybe, in a few instances, we've been wrong. And we need to open our mind to a few possibilities outside what we think we've known for the last 150 years or so. And Robert is somebody who's said this for such a long time. You know, he may not be right about everything. I find him to be a very brilliant man and a wonderfully warm individual. I love talking with Robert anytime I have an opportunity to, because he is very knowledgeable, and he is not a person. He says, and this is one of the greatest compliments I've ever received, I was attending one of his lectures, and he had said to the audience, he says, we must always be skeptical. He says, I'm skeptical of everything, just like Micah Hanks, and he points at me and he says, Micah Hanks always says during his lectures, we must be skeptical of everything. But sometimes our skepticism must require us to also be skeptical of old ideas when data sets that emerge offer a new opinion based on data. Am I making myself clear? I hope so. Okay, enough proselytizing. Although, you know, Tyler, last night on the Micah Hanks radio program, that was something that we were talking about, was the way that a lot of people have said that this last episode of Cosmos that aired Sunday night with Neil deGrasse Tyson, made this strong call for faith in science. Faith in science. Faith in science. There is, according to many, a very spiritual component to science and the scientists who are pushing an almost dogmatic belief system oriented around science, which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing. I mean, I am a scientific thinker, a logical thinker, and a lover of science. I am, and you guys know, I mean, like the guys when they come to the bunker, I mean, it's like a laboratory in here. There are literally beakers and vials and things lying around, textbooks, which is wonderful, but that's part of what I like to have in the bunker. I like for this environment to be, something that is an educative environment. There are books, and they're not just books on, you know, paranormal phenomena and things. There are, you know, physics textbooks, history books and things, and I always tell people when they come here, this is just like any other library. These books can be checked out, but you must bring them back, because the spread of intelligence and good knowledge is important to me. And I'm sorry, Tyler, go ahead.
I just, you know, have faith in science. Be wary of anyone who says you need to have faith in something.
Well, you know, it's funny. My dad and I, years ago, we got to meet the former Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, I believe, was his name. It was George Carey. George Carey, the former Archbishop of Canterbury. And Dad and I met him and got to talk to him for some time. And then we attended, well, it was a sermon in these circumstances, but, you know, I mean, if you think about it from a spiritually scientific perspective, would you call that a spiritual lecture? You know, I mean, isn't that kind of what a sermon is, a lecture on a spiritual subject?
Depends on the person giving it.
Or maybe the person listening.
Yeah.
Anyway, it was a sermon.
The only group I can think of that espouses faith and science is the Church of Scientology, and we're all pretty up to that idea.
Well, I want to tell you what George Carey said, because he said he gave this lecture, and it was on faith. And what he said faith was, he defined faith as the opposite of certainty. And he said that this is why, as Christians, we need to remember the importance of having faith, because he says we cannot be certain all the time. And faith is having basically a justified belief, having belief in the absence of utter certainty. But now the thing is that maybe not everyone would define faith that way. But I ask you, if we were to look at faith as being essentially belief, you know, in the absence of full certainty of the circumstances, sure, we should do that with science, because science is an incomplete picture. We don't have all the answers. But the thing is that I'm afraid that there are people who interpret it as being, no, we must believe what science teaches us, because science is, well, everything. And we do have all the answers via science. We don't have all the answers. I think that science affords us a greater understanding of the universe than we've ever had at any time prior to this moment in history right now.
What it is, it's the tool that will allow us to identify and pinpoint information that will lead, in my belief, to better outcomes.
Wait, in your belief or in your interpretation?
My belief, I would say, because I do have faith, you know what I mean? I'm not one that goes around without it, and I was being kind of tongue-in-cheek.
No,
but,
I know.
You know, my concern is we're all aware of institutional players that use and manipulate the word science and the process for their own benefit. Whenever you have an acting body like the National Institute of whatever, health, science, space, exploration, you need to remember these boards are composed of people who are voted on, much like a political process, based on what their peers' attitudes and outlooks are. So,
yeah, exactly.
Whenever you hear a mouthpiece for anything, it's essentially being funded for by industry, regardless if it's a public utility industry or a public relations industry or a human resources industry. You know what I mean?
I should point out, folks at home, this coming from the most scientifically trained individual in the bunker at this time.
Hey, you have to think about this as well. The word faith, in my opinion, has the same sort of stigma attached to it that UFO does, because usually when you hear the word faith used in some sort of mainstream reporting or something like that, there's a stigma of religion that is kind of attached to that, and that's something that you have to kind of almost explain when you say you are a faithful person, because, you know, I have faith in science. I don't consider myself necessarily a traditional religious person, but I do consider myself, in my context, a spiritual person, and by that regard, I have faith in the future. I have faith in the sciences. I have faith in humanity. So, you know, I think in this day and age, you really have to define what your interpretation of faith is.
And that's the key right there, Caleb, is that so much of this is an argument that is based in semantics. Well, okay, I'm sorry. Micah Hanks is talking about UFOs again. He believes that aliens flying spaceships from Zeta to Reticuli are coming down to Earth. No. In fact, I don't believe that. In fact, when I talk about a UFO, I mean exactly what that term was intended to mean when it was first used by Edward Ruppelt back in the 1950s, unidentified flying object. It was intentionally ambiguous because we are dealing with unknown quantities. And this is exactly what Neil deGrasse Tyson has said and has been attacked for saying, by the way, although I agree with him. When he talks about UFOs, there's a great clip on YouTube. Just go look on YouTube and do a search for Neil deGrasse Tyson on UFOs. And someone asks him about UFOs, and he sits there and he acts like he's being a little dismissive. But you have to understand, I think in addition to being a scientist, a brilliant astrophysicist, he is also a public personality. He is also a bit of an actor, and that's not a bad thing. You have to be able to be that if you're going to be on camera all the time like he is. Now, Tyson, he is asked about UFOs, and he says, here's the problem I have with UFOs. Someone sees a light in the sky. They look at that. Wow, look at that light. I don't know what that is. It must be an alien spaceship from another planet. And he correctly identifies the leap in logic that is required for people who make the presumption that a UFO, an unidentified flying object, must be something from outer space. We have no proof, and I can tell you this in certainty, while the possibility of extraterrestrial visitation to planet Earth may indeed and possibly does exist, we have no proof that that's what UFOs are. And so I realize that there is a semantic argument that has to be made, especially when we understand what we're saying versus what we're interpreting that someone else has said. Okay, now when we come back after this break, we're going to get back to the news and look at the way that certain things are being put out to you that may not actually be as they are. I'm Micah Hanks. It is the Graylian Report. We'll be right back. I'm Micah Hanks. This is the Graylian Report. You're hearing the angelic voice of Beth Arzy, one of our favorite listeners. And of course, if you're a musician and you'd like to hear some of your music featured here on the program, send it along to Tyler Pittman, tyler@graylianreport.com. He is the music master here in the bunker. We'd love to hear from you. You could also send it to Caleb. Caleb is probably as musical, if not more musical, than anyone in this room. He's just a real talent. God love him, he's so talented.
Flattery will get you everywhere.
I know. That's why I work at it. Now, actually, speaking of flattery, Tyler, you know, in the break you were making some great points, and I just literally said I want you to come back and just start this segment with what you were talking about. So take it away there.
Sure, I'll just run down these points quickly. They were coming to me, and I wanted to grab paper because I often lose train of thought when I'm actively thinking.
Sure, so funny how that works, huh?
The word faith to me, when you're talking about the spiritual community, I often hear it used in a denigrative fashion.
Sure.
For instance, faith healers, those who rely on spirit or some divine healing process by which they are a conduit in order to heal someone miraculously without the help of modern medicine.
Uh-huh.
Also, something that bothers me about scientific research and all this stuff that we're supposed to take bar none from the mouthpiece that we live vicariously through, you know, because they fit our personal paradigm, is the lack of transparency in a lot of this. Aaron Schwartz was working on a system, I hear, before he sadly passed away, where he was making available all this institutionally supported scientific research freely available to anyone who was interested in reading it. To me, that would be better evidence of a culture that actually values the scientific method than just taking someone's word for it, just like you would your priest or something like that. But ultimately, you know, if you want to see what the state of science and what regard it is held in America, look at what's happening to one of our most beloved institutions here at the Report, NASA, constantly and increasingly being deconstructed and fed to private corporate interests.
Yeah.
And people somehow champion that, like, this will be great. This will be great. No, it won't. You're simply taking the power away from the people and funneling it into a very small segment of people who are in that realm for a profit. And there's all sorts of issues I have with it. It's not that, you know, I'm not a communist over here.
No, I understand.
But, I mean, it should be visible to anyone who follows the news that they're telling you one thing, and something else is happening.
Yeah. Boy, did you not just strike the main nerve? I just have to commend you, Tyler Pittman, because, I mean, that is exactly what we're talking about here. They're telling you one thing. Okay, you're watching the right hand while the left hand is doing whatever.
And same thing goes with medicine right now. Increasingly, we have government getting involved with that, which used to be a, you know, private industry, essentially.
I think what's funny is that there are certain industries that are better as private. Maybe space, you know, exploration will be just as well, but it's sad that, you know, while we put so much value behind science, I see what you're saying, we're also literally taking away... virtually any ability for what has traditionally been known as the space program, the governmental space program in the United States, to really achieve its long-term goals.
Well, in the case with increasing government involvement in healthcare issues, you know, that's taxpayer-funded. With NASA, the privatization of the space exploration program is being subsidized by taxpayers' money, except taxpayers are not going to see the benefit of what comes from whatever breakthroughs they may have. They may have legitimate, you know, ideas and accomplish what NASA used to do, or it could just be a stumbling block that we will soon regret.
I guess we'll see. You know, time will tell. All very good points, by the way. Now, listen, and I almost, you know, after that, after what you're saying there, I almost hate to have to shift gears, but, you know, in the interest of time here, I want to try and squeeze one more story in that is of great importance during this hour, because next hour we're going to change gears a little, and we're going to head into the realm of cryptozoology. And it's funny because, you know, when I say cryptozoology, I think a lot of people, maybe unfortunately we should use a different term, because I say that and a lot of people think, oh, okay, and yeah, whatever, Bigfoot and everything. You know, I'm fascinated by Bigfoot. I'm equally or more fascinated by reports of feral humans. And in my personal view, I think that the overwhelming number of reports of encounters with or sightings of hairy, bipedal, man-like creatures warrants far more than just, you know, okay, that's interesting, that's kind of funny, but I'm not going to put much stock in it. Time and time again, I see people in the scientific community do this, not all of them, and there are legitimate questions about this purported phenomenon that scientifically we have to ask, hard questions. One being, well, if there are enough of these creatures to support a breeding population, why do we never find a body? You know, how are these things feeding themselves in certain localities, in certain areas where they're seen? I don't think that's as much a problem as it is in others. But I think that especially in the Pacific Northwest, while there are very large varieties of land mammals, moose, Kodiak bears, different things like this that are capable of existing in this same environment, I think that the big question is that if there's something that is humanoid but purportedly as large as Bigfoot is said to be, how does this thing live? How does it feed itself? And even if it succeeds at those two elements, how does it remain hidden? How do they? Because it's not just one. There would have to be, again, a breeding population. Hard questions need to be asked if we're to understand what's going on. But by the same token, and I've said it so many times, but John Napier, former primatologist with the Smithsonian Institute, had even said himself that, you know, based on the evidence, I'm sure that there is something going on, and we cannot rule that out. The thing is that it may not be all that it's cracked up to be. Now, what would he mean by that? What would you mean if you're saying, okay, Bigfoot, there's got to be something going on, but it may not be all that it's cracked up to be? Again, I think if we're going to understand Bigfoot, we've got to look at ourselves, and we've got to stop looking at this purported creature as a creature. We've got to look at it as being human, because this thing, if it exists, that's a big if, a really big if, in fact, based on the eyewitness reports, but it's a big if, and if that thing out there is, which is said to exist, and which so many have said that they've seen, if it is real, understanding it is going to be concomitant with understanding ourselves, because I don't think that this can be treated like any other animal. It's more human than anything. Now, that said, the final story I want to talk about this week, before we get into some crypto discussion in the next hour, has to do with the world's oldest man. You may have heard over the weekend that this gentleman passed away, Alexander Imich. He was 111 years old, and he only held the title of world's oldest man for a short time. And of course, there are some 60 women, I think, around the world elsewhere who are much older than the 111-year-old Alexander Imich. But what's interesting about him, and what I think is an important point that needs to be made, is that while he has been recognized and he is most famous in the mainstream media for being the world's oldest man, and he just passed away, a few of the reports talk about the fact that he was a parapsychologist. He was a chemist by trade and also a parapsychologist. Let me qualify that statement a bit. Okay, I think the New York Times called him a psychic researcher. Let me tell you exactly how involved in parapsychology this gentleman was. Okay, he was born in Poland in 1903. By 1929, after a brief period serving with the Polish Special Forces, he was awarded his PhD in zoology. 3 years later, he published his first academic paper in 1932 on the occult. It dealt with research into a Polish medium known as Matilda S. It appeared in a German publication. Unfortunately, I think all existing copies of that that were known to exist were destroyed during the Second World War, and so I don't think it's been recovered. Well, he had trouble finding work in the field of zoology, and so that's when Imich converted into chemistry, and he actually found work in the Soviet-occupied Bialsk block during the Second World War, where he was employed as a chemist, and then later, after the Second World War, after serving in an internment camp, he and his wife, he was released. He found out after the Second World War that most of his family and friends had passed away during the Holocaust, tragically, and therefore he and his wife, Vela, moved to the United States to live. They went first to Pennsylvania and ultimately ended up in New York. Now, Vela began studying psychology while he continued to work as a chemist, but once she actually entered the psychological practice, he began to work more and more seriously with parapsychology. Now, Vela passed away, unfortunately, in 1986. But Imich continued to pursue his interest in the occult with great passion. At age 96, back in 1999, he founded the Anomalous Phenomena Research Center in New York. You got to keep in mind, just a few years before that, in 1995, he had published a collection, he had edited, actually, an academic collection of works pertaining to the supernatural titled Incredible Tales of the Paranormal. So here's a man who has published academic papers, and I'm going to tell you how many here in just a moment. But someone who's really devoted his life to this, by the time he's in his 90s, when most people, they aren't even alive, let alone those who do survive that long, they're winding down. This gentleman publishes his first academic collection of paranormal. I don't know if it was his first, but I know that that was probably the last significant one that he passed. And then he founds the Anomalous Phenomena Research Center in 1999 when he's 96 years old. And with this, he essentially was trying to put together a research project and gain funding for what he called the crucial demonstration, in which he hoped to find demonstrable proof of the reality of paranormal phenomena that he could offer to mainstream scientists and the general public. Now, I want to quote some things that he had written in 2002. He wrote a paper that was featured at the E-Journal of the Mind Shift Institute, and he was talking about Nobel Prizes. And what he wrote was, he says, "The disciplines I propose for the new prize will help us in the exploration of outer space and help us become beings worthy of moving beyond our war-torn planet. Cyber science and mathematics will help in the development of technology of space travel. They are all vital tools for exploring outer space. Psychology and philosophy will help us to learn who we are and to understand the motivations of our actions. They are essential tools for exploring inner space. In my life, I have witnessed the development of flight, the automobile, electrification of nations, the telephone, the radio, and television, atomic energy, the wonders of bioscientific medicine, computer technology, great advances in our knowledge of the cosmos, men walking on the moon. The list could go on and on. Many contributions to these areas have been recognized by the Nobel Prize Committee, but not all. There are many others who also deserve the highest scientific honor." Now, fortunately, in around 2012, Imich had begun to have his personal files that he'd collected and written and amassed over his lifetime passed to the University of Manitoba Department of Archives and Special Collections, which collected essentially his writings, and they continue to keep them and maintain them and actually have a catalog listing on their website that spanned the years from 1932 to 2002. Now, this is an individual who truly devoted his life to the study of paranormal phenomena, and he's listed in these articles as, well, basically being a, well, chemist and a parapsychologist. I don't think that there's been one paper, one article, one obituary, anything that has really hit home with regard to how influential this gentleman has been on this field, and we recognize him tonight on the program. Thank you, Alexander, for your work, and may the ever after continue to be as rewarding for you as life was in your old age. We'll miss you. This is the Grayling Report. When we come back, we'll continue our foray into the news, looking at cryptozoology and sea monsters. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome to your home for weird news, anomalies, exopolitics, and all things that go bump in the night. It's the Grayling Report with Micah Hanks. Exopolitics. It's beyond the fringe, where conspiracy theory can become conspiracy fact. This is the Grayling Report with your host, Micah Hanks.
From the dark heart of Appalachia, where the sentinels stand tall, welcome back, my friends. It is the Grayling Report. And although normally Asheville, where we make our home, is the beautiful land of the sky, Paris of the South, it's a little bit dark and stormy a few hundred miles above us right now. And unfortunately, our internet cables still have to feed from above ground. I'm hoping there won't be any outages anyplace out there. So keep your fingers crossed. We like it when we can maintain broadcast excellence. But we've got to also be able to keep the power on in order to do that. And there is severe weather moving across the southeastern United States. We'll keep you posted. And if you're someplace in the southeast and you've got updates, we'd like to hear from you. info@graylingreport.com. Or you can even reach us on Skype at Grayling Report. And then, of course, there's the old traditional landline method, 828-398-4886. We'll get you live into the bunker just as well, so long as the phone lines stay up. Now, that said, I want to also point out that next week, returning maybe his, God, fourth or fifth time on the program, I think that we probably have the most appearances of this guest of any in history. And the reason why is because this is an individual who puts out so much information and so regularly. You probably already guessed who I'm talking about. The one and only Nick Redfern will be joining us to discuss his new book. It's called Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind, Suspicious Deaths, Mysterious Murders, and Bizarre Disappearances in UFO History. Now, this book, I mean, it has a very sensational cover and a very sensational title, but I know Nick to be a fantastic researcher, and actually, I had the pleasure of catching up and talking with him for about 45 minutes on the phone the other day, just discussing this and that. We were actually discussing some three-letter agencies and some of our mutual research and interests. And I tell you, there when it comes to being a writer, there are people who I've learned from. I used to love the writing of Lauren Coleman, sociologist and also cryptozoologist, a subject we're going to talk about a good bit this hour. Nick has written a lot about cryptozoology just as well. This new book we're going to be talking about with him next week on the program deals with ufology or UFOology, UFOs in essence. But the thing is that it's a very dark aspect of UFO research that he's going to be focusing on. Have you ever gone to, and I know that you know, a lot of my friends, some of the people in the chat room, Graham, of course, of Grimerica, who's in there tonight, you know, we've attended a lot of conferences together where, you know, you will see this kind of, not that it's bad, I think it's good to be positive, but you see a lot of this love and light at the UFO conferences. And my other friend, co-host of the Paracast, Chris O'Brien, recently was complaining to me, and rightly so, he's completely justified, about a particular conference that Caleb and I were attending recently that once was the location for networking and the location for serious research into unidentified aerial phenomena, and now it's been overtaken by this kind of new age love and light stuff. Nothing wrong with new age. Nothing wrong with love and light. I mean, I talk about cosmic love on this program. We just had a discussion of faith and science in the last hour. I mean, I think these are all subjects that are worthy of recognition and things that we all kind of adhere to and discuss openly on this program. But I'll also tell you that by the same token, the problem is that when these become the central focus of a conference that is supposed to be focusing on the study of unidentified flying objects, and remember what I said in the last hour. Remember the way I was trying to term this subject. You know, oh, Micah Hanks, if he talks about UFOs, he believes in aliens from outer space. No, I know that there is a possibility that I acknowledge. But UFO by itself cannot prove the existence of aliens. And the UFO phenomenon may or may not have to do with that subject. Poor Jacques Vallée. Poor Jacques Vallée. I remember the story that Christopher O'Brien, who we just mentioned, had told me about Jacques Vallée. And when he first got up, I think, at one of the big MUFON symposiums, I think it may have been in 1986 or 7, I'm not sure. And he talked about how Jacques Vallée got on stage and he presents this incredible thesis. He says, I am convinced as a computer scientist, based on my research, that the UFO phenomenon represents, at times, and these may be the minority of the cases, but at times it represents a non-human intelligence interacting with us, and that there appears to be a control mechanism, but I have no evidence, and I can offer you none, that whatever this intelligence is extraterrestrial. He was booed off of the stage. Think about that. When somebody, think about all the people who come along and they offer an opinion. People in the UFO community, and I'm not trying to attack you, but I'm going to have to say some harsh things really quickly, and I'm sorry, if you disagree, you're just going to have to eat this. Because people in the UFO community, just like a lot of people in other communities, in other ideologies, they become so beholden to what the paradigm that they have been fed is taken to be. They believe, they want to believe more than they actually accept based on the data. And whether it's Robert Schock saying, no, you what? I'll tell you what, that Sphinx, first of all, wasn't always a Sphinx. And second of all, the damn thing's a lot older than people realize, and probably the pyramids are too. Or whether it's Jacques Vallée saying, look, there is some sort of a control system involving this unidentified aerial phenomenon. Something that works in conjunction with human activity, human minds, human consciousness. It may not be something that originates from humans itself, but whatever it is capable of interacting with us and even controlling aspects of us. But I couldn't tell you that that's alien. It gets booed off the stage. This is what happens when brilliant people come up with brilliant ideas. Think back through history. People who have challenged the accepted norm. The scientists of the arcane eras, you know, who challenged the church and were burned at the stake for doing so. It's a shame. We're not very far from that, even in the modern day. The only difference is that we don't burn people at the stake. We just castigate them, laugh at them, or boo them off the stage when they bring these ideas up. Red Pill Junkie in the chat room right now. Boo! Now, fortunately, I don't think that anyone's booed Nick Redfern off the stage, but he is going to be talking next week about something that is completely, if anything, it's the antithesis of the Love and the Light crowd that kind of, you know, camp out at these UFO events. Love and Light's great, but there is a broader phenomenon that must be addressed, and I don't think anyone has done a comprehensive analysis in a single book of these negative and even often deaths and mutilations and disappearances that occur in conjunction with UFO reports. Close Encounters of the Fatal Kind has done that, and so Nick's going to join us on the program next week. I can't wait to talk with him about that. But Nick, again, you know, is a guy who's written a lot about cryptozoology too, and that's one of the big stories that we have this week, cryptozoology. Now, Caleb found this story. I had not heard of this, and the other night we were both delirious. We were both tired. I think we played a gig that night. Was it Friday or Saturday, I think?
Saturday. I was awake for 30 hours.
Well, why don't you actually set the stage for this one?
Well,
I'm tired of hearing myself talking. You've got a snazzy microphone over there, so why don't you set the stage for this one?
My incredible story goes like this.
I
came home, and somewhere on my Facebook feed, there was a story about a shark being eaten by some large, mysterious creature that can swim to incredible depths. Which actually really weren't all that incredible.
I think it's pretty incredible. Tyler, don't you think that's pretty incredible?
Yes.
I think it's scary. Yeah! Another guy fell down the hole. I keep telling him not to go back there.
We gotta cover up that open well back there.
God,
the intern keeps losing it, Minesweeper. Cut the mic in there.
Oh, God. Anyway, so, yeah. So Caleb sends this. He says, have you heard this story about this giant something that swallowed a great white shark?
Yes, I keep thinking of that movie, Honey, I Blew Up the Kid. That big giant baby eating a pack of those shark attack gummies.
That's what it is. Case closed. We solved it right here, folks. Okay, so here's the story. And here's what's funny is, even as recently as today, CNN News was writing about this. I want you, again, we've talked about this the entire program. The way that the media feeds this stuff to you is not how it really is. I want you to hear this story in a moment, but first, the headline. What devoured this great white shark?
Micah, are you positing that the media might exaggerate headlines to potentially get people to read their crap?
That's what it is. We have to trick people into reading, because otherwise they won't read at all. Okay, so this story. What devoured this great white shark? CNN. Australian researchers are hunting for what they call a mystery sea monster that devoured a 9-foot-long great white shark. Okay, that's what's called your lead, or your nut graph, I guess, in journalistic terms. Your opening statement there.
My God, where's Richard Dreyfuss when we need him?
Let me read that again. Australian researchers are hunting for what they call a mystery sea monster that devoured a 9-foot-long great white shark. Now, somebody like me or Nick Redfern or Caleb or Tyler comes along, and we read that, and we go, Godzilla! No, actually, I read that, and I'm thinking, oh, wow, that's tantalizing. That maybe is something. My God, maybe, just maybe, this is the one we've been looking for. Maybe this is the real deal. Maybe this is an actual sea monster. Well, you got to read a little further, okay? A tracking device previously planted on the shark was found washed up on a beach, and after analysis, it showed that it had suddenly undergone a rapid increase in temperature and a swift 1,900-foot dive beneath the waves. Still pretty compelling, huh? Yeah? Now, scientists attribute the more than 30-degree spike in temperature to the shark entering another animal's digestive system. And the unexpected plunge could be explained by the larger animal's rapid descent. Now, researchers found the tracking device about 2.5 miles from where the shark had been tagged. The perplexing situation, which occurred 4 months after researchers tagged the shark, is chronicled in the Smithsonian Institute's documentary film, Hunt for the Super Predator, which airs in the United States on the 25th of this month, of June, 2014. When I was first told about the data that came back from the tag that was on the shark, I was absolutely blown away, says filmmaker David Riggs in the documentary. The question
Riggs.
So we know that the story is simply a PR campaign for the documentary that will be out soon.
That's one aspect to this, yeah.
Because we know it's not Nessie or Falco or...
We're dealing with an even bigger creature. It's not Jaws, it's Jowls.
It's the Discovery Channel.
We've got a great graphic that we posted to Facebook earlier today. And if you follow Graylian Report on Facebook, just do a search for us. If you don't follow us, you want to see this graphic. You know, it's a great white shark being eaten by a really, really giant toothless old man shark being swallowed by an even larger giant something with shark teeth.
It's like a Russian doll of sharks.
Exactly. It's terrifying. Yes. Human sharkipede. Or shark... Never mind.
I like where you were going with that.
I don't. But anyway, now the perplexing situation, which occurred 4 months after researchers tagged the shark, as Tyler points out, is probably some sort of a promotion for this upcoming documentary, Hunt for the Super Predator. When I was first told about the data that came back from the tag that was on the shark, I was absolutely blown away, said Dave Riggs. The question that not only came to mind, but everyone's mind who was involved was, what did that? What could have eaten a 9-foot-long great white shark?
It's perfect. The title is Search for the Super Predator, and it just so happens while we're doing this film, we're looking for the Super Predator.
To catch a Super Predator.
Funny enough, they think that they may be on the trail of a Super Predator.
It's a coincidence.
Chris Hansen gets on his yacht to pursue the Super Predator.
Giant sharks pursue our heroes when we come back. Well... So an additional study of sharks in the area provided a possible answer. Okay, now we're starting to get to the real data. Get this. According to researchers, larger great whites were found in the spot where the original shark met its fate. Now listen, I got to tell you. I have had so many emails from people this week about this story. Caleb was the first. One of my absolute favorite people in the world, Billy Clark, actually sent this to me today, along with some extremely meaningful commentary, which we will get to in a moment. Billy always takes it above and beyond. And I sense that he and I, it's inevitable. There's no way to avoid it at this point. Billy and I are destined to adventure together at some point. And at some point in the course of our adventures, we're going to end up at St. James Gate in Dublin, and we're going to be drinking Guinness. But aside from that, there's going to be a lot of adventure, too. But I'll tell you this. This story, I've pointed out to just about everyone who I can, who has emailed it to me. I've said, listen, you've got to keep in mind that great white sharks get much. I think they can get up to maybe in excess of 20 feet long. Now, we're talking about a 9-foot-long shark. These creatures at times have been known to predate one another in a particular environment. If there are bigger sharks in an area, in other words, they will cannibalize. They will actually consume a smaller great white. Okay, so if a great white is 9 feet, you know, long, yeah, that's going to be a serious threat to seals or humans who are maybe swimming nearby. But that shark is going to be at risk if there are larger great white sharks in the area, because they will literally feed on one another. Now, these huge sharks, CNN reports, are big enough to have eaten another great white and are able to dive at the speed and depth observed by the tracking device. It's not unprecedented for sharks to eat other sharks, and the researchers posit that a 2-ton colossible...
colossible.
I create another word.
A 2,000-ton lunchable squid.
I've been upgraded. I'm now a level 69 wizard, a flame mage. Yes, this flame mage just created a new word, colossible. Which is kind of like, what's that word? I don't know. Anyway, I'm sorry. I was thinking of another word, but...
Constantinople.
No, it used to be... What was it? Let's see here. They changed it to Istanbul, right? Right?
Istanbul?
No, Istanbul.
Huxtable? Yes.
Constantinople was changed. Why they changed it, I can't say. I guess folks just liked it better that way. I mean, but... Well, no, here's the thing. So they say it's not unprecedented for sharks to eat other sharks. Not sharks. Death by shark. Robert Shock ate that shark. He killed it.
And he wasn't even hungry.
Well, he ate it because it was GMO free. It was USDA organic. No, I'm sorry. If anyone knows Robert, and again, a dear friend, he and his wife, you know, they are crusaders against, as I am, honestly, genetically modified foods, and also they are advocates of a gluten-free diet. And I'm telling you, if you want to know about that, if you want to hear about the science that you probably haven't heard about with regard to that field of interest, yeah, you need to talk to Robert and his wife, Katie. Actually, Robert is very knowledgeable. He'll even tell you. Katie's the one who's really the brain about this, and Katie sent me a number of videos dealing with that subject, and again, fascinating people to be around. Anyway, so that said, researchers are saying that a 2-ton colossal cannibal great white shark, not a secret weaponized alien megalodon. Okay.
Which was disappointing.
That was what IO9 had said, and that was the best thing I've ever heard. Secret weaponized alien megalodon.
Well, you remember the story out of Russia that they were equipping sharks with laser and projectiles and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, like
well, no, those were dolphins, right?
Beer guns.
I can't
dolphins. No, it
might
dolphins.
Have been dolphins.
They were equipping dolphins with guns as I whack my microphone over here, you know. Oh, God, yes, yes. Secret weaponized ancient megalodons. That's what we're dealing with. No, 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 no.
The wisdom of the megalodon.
These things, yeah. Scientists are actually saying that a 2-ton colossal cannibal great white shark is likely the culprit in this case. Okay, so, case closed. Mystery solved, right? There it is. It wasn't a giant sea monster. In fact, it was probably just a giant great white that ate a slightly smaller great white. But is that really all there is to it? When we come back, I want to tell you a little bit about some real sea monsters that I've taken interest in recent years. There may be things far larger and far scarier than great whites out there in our oceans. We'll talk about that when we come back here on the Graylian Report. Micah Hanks. This is the Grayling Report, hearing the sounds of Lawson and our dear friend, the avid dabbler known as Luke, who lurks in the chat room every Tuesday night here on the Grayling Report. If you're not jumping in the chat room, you're missing out on the hottest conversation, or maybe just the hardest conversation anywhere on the World Wide Web. You know, what's really cool is we offer our Graylian listener-only chat room right there at the Graylian Report. If you visit the website, it's graylianreport.com/podcast and radio. You'll see that. Boy, have we got a lot of stuff there for you at the site. And again, I urge people. Some jerk actually even got on iTunes a while back and said, I don't want to listen to that show. All they do is talk about their stuff on their website.
What the hell else do you want to hear, kiddo?
No. I mean, we happen to have a website where we, you know, feature articles and videos and commentary. You know, no, we're not going to mention anything like that on our podcast. That would make absolutely no sense. The mind reels. Anyway, by the way, someone in the chat room says they missed who the singer was. That was Luke. I hope I'm not giving away too much.
Luke.
He says, okay, that's enough. Anyway, but he is avid dabbler there in the chat room.
You're too old for the Jedi training.
You will be. You will be. I think we're going to have to host the entire show one night as Triple Yoda. Tyler, can you do a Yoda?
That's chewy,
yeah. Oh, what a wonderful new smell you've discovered.
Isn't Yoda the one that's like,
come here, yeah, get over here, yeah.
I'm sorry, that song, by the way, was Lawson that we heard. The band is called Above the Sky. I was wrong about that. The band is called Above the Sky. I should know that, Luke. Anyway.
Sorry, Luke.
Yes. Now, that said, we were talking in the last segment about what could possibly consume a great white, and I think that the answer is quite simple. Look no further than Exhibit A. The one being eaten was probably being eaten by the one being eaten. In other words, shark chases his own tail. Yes. Now, no, the shark didn't eat itself. No, it was eaten by another shark. But Billy Clark and I, we were corresponding earlier today about this, and he said, you know, Hanksy, there are some stories, though, out there, and there's some articles I've found over the years. I'm going to try and dig some of these up and send you some information about these. Because what we may be dealing with here is the scientific possibility that there actually are animals, not only in the ocean, that are as yet undiscovered, but that are potentially very, very large. And he sent me a series of three articles that are so in keeping with some of my own research. Check this out. Okay, this first one that I'm going to read to you dates back to July 13th, 2011. A little dated. But the information, I think, is still relevant. The title of the article is Sea Monsters Really Do Lurk Beneath the Waves, Scientists Claim. From krakens to giant sea serpents, terrifying monsters of the deep have haunted the imaginations of generations of mariners. Now experts in marine life claim sea monsters might actually exist. Because scientists are still finding new species of underwater life. The discovery of marine monsters is not impossible, according to a meeting that met yesterday. This was reported by the Daily Mail in the UK. Now, the huge number of sea monster sightings now on record can't all be explained away as mistakes, sightings of known animals, or hoaxes, according to paleontologist Dr. Darren Naish of the University of Portsmouth. At least some of the better ones, he went on to say, some of them made by trained naturalists and such, probably are descriptions of encounters with real, unknown animals. One such example was reported in 1905 by zoologists Edmund Mead Waldo and Michael Nicoli, who encountered a strange, quote, sea serpent off the coast of Brazil. And in August of 1848, a famous case, and one that I've always been fascinated with, the crew of the HMS Daedalus saw a 60-foot-long sea creature during a voyage to St. Helena in the South Atlantic. And there are some absolutely classic, haunting artistic renderings of the serpent viewed by the crew aboard the Daedalus that if you search for that online, it's D-A-E-D-A-L-U-S, Daedalus. If you search for that online, you'll be able to see these famous images. Now, at the time, biologists in London claimed that what the crew aboard the Daedalus had seen was most likely an elephant seal, or maybe just an upside-down canoe. Imagine that. Here we thought it was a sea serpent we'd seen, and it was really just a great big wooden canoe. What a shame. I don't buy that. And I don't buy it because if you read the account that was kept in the ship's log, the report that was filed described a creature that resembled a reptile that held its head above the water that continued to swim along, and they observed it for quite some time. Now, Dr. Naish told yesterday's meeting, and of course this is going all the way back to 2011, but the article continues reading that the Zoological Society of London met and said, Dr. Naish before the society, because large marine animals continue to be discovered, various new whale and shark species have even been named in recent years. I think last year, guys, we had found two new species, I think, of dolphins, several new species of snakes, frogs, and other kinds of reptiles, and the majority of them down there off the coast, or actually on the mainland in the case of the reptiles, of Australia, which is exactly where this great white shark went missing.
Not to mention we've also found insects where the females had male genitalia this year.
Yeah. Dude, I'm telling you, everything we think we know, again, guys, whatever you think the paradigm is, throw that out the window. What you think you know, you don't know half of what you think you know. Wow, that sounds a lot like something Robert Bigelow said once. But anyway, so the whole point is that, and there's a skeptical perspective that's offered here too that I want to get to in fairness toward the end of this article. Some people, it says, have suggested present-day monsters might be plesiosaurs, but long-necked marine mammals that lived at the time of dinosaurs were dismissed by Dr. Charles Paxton at the University of St. Andrews, who organized yesterday's meeting. The meeting was titled, and this is important, Cryptozoology, Science or Pseudoscience. There's the P word again, and I'm not talking plesiosaur. If there are prehistoric animals alive today, he says, it would imply that there's something very wrong with our understanding of the fossil record. Now, that may be the case, but I actually err to Paxton's feelings in this instance. The fossil record, okay, we probably do have a fairly good understanding of the fossil record, but that doesn't mean that there may not be other large creatures as yet undiscovered that exist in our oceans. They may not be holdovers from an ancient time. They may not be plesiosaurs, but that doesn't mean that there aren't other animals. Later in the program, we're going to get to what I think personally that some of those may have been. Another article that Billy sends along in making his case, this one was really good. Oceans could contain 750,000 undiscovered species. I think this article appeared on October 3rd, 2010, going back 1 year. Giant sea spiders the size of dinner plates, wriggling creatures nicknamed squid worms because of their strange-looking tentacles, a blind lobster whose Latin name means terrible claw. These are among the new types of animals discovered in the most ambitious ever survey of the world's oceans, which concludes tomorrow with the publication of the first census of marine life. The report remarks, or rather it marks the first attempt to provide a definitive record of all the species of plants and animals living in the sea, but I'm going to tell you this. It will reveal that almost 250,000 have now been identified, while predicting that there may be at least another 750,000 still waiting to be discovered beneath the waves. Now, keep in mind, of course, that the majority of these remain elusive because of their size. No, they're not large and hiding at unfathomable depths. No, they're probably extremely small. Some of them may even be extremophiles. Caleb, what are you laughing at? I can only imagine. Don't say it. Anyway, I'm looking at the chat room. This final story that Billy sends along, Monsters of the Deep Still Undiscovered. Now, this one was from 2008. I'm reading these in reverse order. But listen to this. Richard Gray writes, given their size, you might assume that they all had been found by now, but scientists believe the world's oceans are still hiding giant underwater creatures which have yet to be discovered. Marine ecologists have predicted that there could be as many as 18 unknown species. Now, keep in mind what I just read you. Okay. Dating back to 2010, the idea that there may be 750,000 different species out there as yet undiscovered. Some of them may be extremophiles that hang out around lava vents and things deep, deep, deep beneath the ocean within the Hadal Zone. Andrew, if you're still listening, by the way, that is an actual region of the deepest depths of the ocean's crevices beneath, that literally go down beneath the actual ocean's floor and take us to depths. If you want to envision this, kind of imagine the climax at the ending of the film The Abyss. Okay, this is kind of an idea of the Hadal Zone. Well, using statistical modeling, scientists, marine ecologists have predicted that there could be as many as 18 unknown species They measured the rate at which new large sea creatures have been discovered since 1830 and found that the rate of discovery is still going strong and that, based on statistical data, with new species being found every year, there is a high likelihood that large, maybe giant, marine species could exist. But due to the, well, not only the unfathomable depths, but also just the incredible expanse of the planet that is covered by oceans, that these animals are capable of remaining hidden. Okay. Now, most recently, scientists found a new species of jellyfish that's more than 3.5 meters long, bigger than the great white shark that went missing off the coast of Australia. But get this. Anyone want to guess where this jellyfish was discovered, this new variety of 3.5-meter jellyfish? Where do you think it was found?
Madagascar's coast.
I'm going to say the deserts of Nevada.
Very close, Caleb. Yes, it was an air jellyfish. Yes, a flying gopal. No, what we were talking about here was discovered off of the coast of New Zealand, along with a meter-wide new species of starfish. Now, granted, this, again, story dates back to 2008. But even that recently, giant sea creatures have been found. The first full-sized carcass of a colossal squid, a deep-sea monster 4 meters long, was revealed for the first time in 2008 just as well. Now, interestingly, the skeptic who had put on the conference in the first story in this sequence of three that I'm talking about here, Charles Paxton, is quoted again here, and he says, "There are plenty of places that these creatures could be hiding. They may spend their lives in the middle layers of the oceans and never surface to be in the deep sea canyons yet to be visited. And new discoveries are being made all the time under the Arctic ice caps. What about something hiding out under the Arctic ice caps?" It's very interesting. But he says, for anyone hoping the results could mean that the Loch Ness Monster might still be lurking in the depths of the loch, he has disappointing news. He says, based on similar analysis of freshwater species, he's concluded that mankind has discovered all the large freshwater creatures that there are to be found. There are small creatures being discovered all the time, but to find a species that are more than 2 meters in length is very rare. Normally, you would expect the rate of discovery of species in a habitat to level off when there are no more to be found. But with large sea creatures, the rates are still to level out, which suggests we have not found them all yet. So please understand that statistically, there is a likelihood that there are probably not only sea creatures out there, among the 750,000 presumed to exist that we have not yet discovered. But in addition to that, we also have a potential, a strong one maybe, statistically, for there to be large creatures that exist someplace out there. Now, what are they? What could be that large? What could exist out there? And could some of these animals, whatever they are, account for reports of sea serpents? When we come back in the final segment of this program, I'm going to give you some startling information, which I think may support the literal existence of what some have called sea serpents. It is the Grayling Report. I'm Micah Hanks, and we'll be back right after this. Welcome back in from the dark heart of Appalachia. It is the Grayling Report with the Grayling Gang, Caleb, Micah, and yours truly, the mouth of the South. Indisputable title that I maintain and proclaim every week on this program known as the Grayling Report. But we bring you news from the darkest corner of the web. Now, this is going to be a slightly longer than usual last segment. And a quick shout out right quick to Lindsay Morrison, one of our dear friends in the chat room. I always like to point out that she's listening because she works extremely hard. I think that there's probably not a day of the week that she doesn't supply at least a few news stories, more often than not, several news stories that appear in our daily roundup. Of course, if anyone out there would like to do what Lindsay does and send us news stories, I'm sorry, I've just got to say that you're never going to ever top her or Jonathan Wilson. They are our senior news hounds, although I hate calling them hounds. It's not exactly flattering, so I should say that they're really our senior news anchors here at the Graylian Report. But we always love to hear from folks, so info@graylianreport.com. You can send your news links every day. Also, Mark Brady helps out an awful lot, and Eileen, you know, a lot of folks send stuff along. So it's easy to do. Just when you find something interesting, shoot us an email, info@graylianreport.com. We'd love to hear from you. Now, in this final segment, we're going to go a little longer than usual because I want to share a hypothesis I've been formulating for quite some time, which has to do with sea monsters, but also I want to come back around to something we mentioned earlier, and that is the work of Carl Sagan. And Caleb and Tyler and I think are going to have a little bit of fun with some of Carl Sagan's reasoning with regard to being able to discern, well, fact from fiction, or fact from, as I think some have called it, BS. Now, the important thing to remember is that throughout this program, what we have continued to try and illustrate is, and even with this story about the shark, these news agencies will bring this to the table and they'll say, what could have swallowed this shark? Some sea monster is what's being searched for. The scientists believe that something swallowed that damn shark. He's going to eat him. Jesus, we're going to need golf shoes to get out of this muck. And then you get to the end of the thing. But the most likely explanation is, of course, that we're actually dealing with another larger shark that probably swallowed the smaller shark that can get up 20 feet long and known to predate themselves and cannibalize their own. Okay, great. Wonderful.
You're listening to NPR.
Which is strangely the subject of the film they were making. And discussing it, you bought it hook, line, and sinker.
You know, and that's the whole thing. You remember this era, and since we're talking about, you know, cryptozoology, really, I think we are.
Yeah, I really think you might.
This Erickson project that we used to hear a lot about in relation to Bigfoots, Mike Riggs appears in a video online where he's talking about where he thinks that this, whatever that was being filmed up there in Kentucky, he had said that there were some clues about this. And I don't know if this necessarily still stands, per se. I think a lot of people have really begun to doubt, really, whatever it is that they claim that they've been filming up there. I mean, you know, unfortunately, that seems to be the case with almost all the what seem to be good Sasquatch stories that come out over the years. You know, we've got, my dad even called me about this today. Todd Standing in this footage that's recently aired where he claims he's captured an adolescent Bigfoot's face on camera. You know, there's the Erickson thing up there in Kentucky. You know, every few years there's something that is purported to be a real, potentially significant discovery in Bigfoot. And we never seem to really get it, but something that Mike Riggs had pointed out in a video online that I saw recently was that he'd said that the way that the people were referring to what was being filmed up there in Kentucky, they did never say Bigfoot. They had said, this is the ultimate survivor. This may not be the rarest creature on the planet, but it's certainly one of the most significant. And he believed that there wasn't even a Bigfoot at all. He had said, and again, this was a video from 2010, so I mean, that information may be a bit dated now, obviously. But at the time, he had said, my feeling is that the people who are putting this information out there are basically promoting this and building hype off of the idea of there being a Bigfoot, but in fact, basically what they're saying, they're describing the ultimate war survivor, you know, the ultimate survivor and something that may not be the rarest creature on the planet, but something, I'm sorry, if it were a Bigfoot, it would be the rarest creature on the planet. And he said, all the evidence based on what they're saying is pointing to it being a wild human. It's probably some dude living out there in the woods, and that they're making a documentary out of this and trying to build that as Bigfoot. Now, as I said earlier, I think maybe to understand Bigfoot, we need to start looking seriously at those reports. And there are a lot of them from Kentucky, interestingly, in my own files that I have that have to do with what people don't describe as Bigfoot, but feral humans. People who have gone off the grid, maybe who have, you've seen films that deal with this idea, the idea of inbreeding out there in the backwoods and things like this.
Yes, but not all feral men are inbred.
Yes! That is correct, Tyler.
Just like Will Ferrell.
There was a book about it. It's called Jungle Book.
Well, Mowgli.
That wasn't very impactful. I apologize.
Come on, Tyler. Really? You can do better than that. Caleb, go ahead. Pull the lever. No, please. There he goes.
Another intern dies.
Every time Tyler says something stupid on the microphone, another intern dies.
It's interesting, though, because I saw the reverse of the feral man would be the urban Farrell person, right? Or these people that
that's
like
Joseph P. Farrell
live down in tunnels. There's a documentary, Darkest Days, following the lives of people who transplant, take themselves from city life and start living under the tunnels in very interesting cities made from cardboard.
Yeah. Living like literally in a sewage system.
So it's not
and stuff.
If you see that in an urban setting and that many people living underground, literally, it's not so hard to imagine people could still be doing that in the mountains.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think that the important thing to remember is that, you know, a lot of people are going to kind of, you know, present what they're trying to sell to you as one thing when, in fact, it is another. And yet again, with the shark story, the likely conclusion here is that the great white was eaten by another great white. But see, all these media outlets, and this is what astounded me. You sent me this story on Sunday night or Saturday night, Caleb, and I went and I found immediately the hypothesis that people are already putting forward. I had carried it, I think, on this. I think maybe the Sploid blog had put it up. A lot of people were already talking about the great white eating a great white story scenario. Okay, and yet CNN is still reporting on this. Remember, at the very beginning of this hour, when I read this story initially, I said, "Pay attention to the title. What devoured this great white shark?" Lead-in sentence. Australian researchers are hunting for what they call a mystery sea monster that devoured a 9-foot-long great... No, they're not! They're not hunting for a mystery sea monster. They're almost certain that they know what happened to that shark. That is BS right there. It's absurd. But this is the way that the media puts it out to you so that you'll continue reading and so that you'll, you know, click their little ads and stuff like that. Now, I have said that within the context of this discussion, I wanted to talk about the possibility of an actual zoological mystery, an actual sea monster. And I've got a book right here that was published way back in 1965. It was written by a man named Gardner Sowell, and it's called The Mystery Monsters. You know, I used to be a book dealer. I used to deal in rare and even antique books and things like that. And I'd sell books online. And I always would, when I found things that interested me or particularly interesting in rare books, I would keep, you know, books like this from my own library, which we discussed the Grailian library earlier. But this book I've kept, and it's, you know, it's bound like, you know, something you see in like an elementary or middle school library from the 1960s and whatnot. It's an older book. But there's a chapter in this book titled The Young Sea Serpent. And there is a story here that is truly one of the most compelling, maybe, that I've ever come across. I mean, ever. One morning in 1930, Anton Brun, a youthful Danish sea scientist, discovered what has become the world's most mysterious eel. The experience dominated the rest of Brun's days. Brun was aboard the Dana, a research ship off of South Africa, when he made the acquaintance of the eel. It was the immature or young form, the larva of an entirely unknown eel, that Brun encountered. It was hauled aboard in a fishing net. The size of the larva was startling. It was 6 feet long. It appeared capable of growing into a real monster of the seas, an eel 50 or 100 or even 150, maybe as much as 180 feet long, a monster fully the equal of any sea beast ever dreamed up by the most imaginative science fiction writer. Before I go any further, let me point out, I think the largest blue whale on record was around 90 feet. We're talking about something, a creature, an eel, that could potentially reach the size of more than 180 feet long. That's roughly double the size of the largest blue whale on record. Now, that's all speculation, but you'll see where this comes from in a moment. Brun set up the rest of his life around this case, trying to answer one question about this eel larva that he had found. Was the larva a young sea serpent? He always thought the answer was yes. To bring up the giant eel larva, the Dana had dropped her trawl about a mile down into the sea. About a mile down. I mean, we're talking about way down there. She wasn't far from the Cape of Good Hope and only a few miles from the position of the South Atlantic, where in 1848 Captain Peter McQuay and crew members of the British frigate known as the Daedalus had sighted an enormous eel-like monster on the ocean's surface. Remember that? Now, Anton Brun, who never could wait for a new haul of specimens to be brought aboard, came out on deck when the net was about to be brought up. It was swung, wet, and dripping to the deck. It held some strange samples of sea life, luminescent fish, fish with protruding eyes, fish with long antennae or feelers. Most of them were small. But these were just ordinary weirdies from mile deep water. The Dana had brought up a lot of queer fish before this, and Brun was unruffled, and then he saw something else that caused him to gawk. What he saw was a whopper. It was fully 6 feet long. Its coils were tangled in the net, but neither Brun nor anyone else there recognized it. It was a large and truly unknown sea creature. Brun examined it. He lifted it into his arms, and then later he studied its features and the structure of its bones. He began to have an idea of what it was, and after he had dissected it, he knew. And what he had learned surprised him. It was indeed, as he had suspected, the larva of an eel. But among known eels, the conger and the moray grow larger than any other. A monster conger can grow, and in exceptional cases does grow, up to 8 or 10 feet long. Now, Dr. Maurice Burton in Animal Legends had said that the record conger was 11 feet long. The record moray was 16 feet long. The larva of these eels are 3 or 4 inches long, 1/30th of their adult length. Now, if the 6-foot larva that Brun had found grew proportionately as long as the conger grows, folks, we're talking about an eel that would grow to a length of 180 feet. And that is absolutely mind-numbing. Now, that book, again, was written in the 1960s, published in 1965. But I've long had an interest in this. And there have been other instances where extraordinarily large leptocephalus have been brought up from the ocean's depths. There was an obscure Japanese report I've mentioned recently on the program that I'd found that mentioned this just as well, and even had some grainy images of the presumed larva. And naturalists, to the best of their ability, explain this by saying it may be that this is a larva of eel, or rather a variety of eel, whose larva is larger than the adult specimen. But think about that for just a minute. How does that happen? How is that even possible? I mean, I'm not saying that it's not possible, and I'm no naturalist, I'm no zoologist or a marine biologist. But something about that really, really does not seem to fall in accordance with common logic. Is it possible that a 6-foot leptocephalus is maybe representative of things that people for hundreds of years, like the crewmen aboard the Daedalus and others, have claimed that they have seen? Could it be that maybe there is indeed a variety of eel? And as this leptocephalus larva was found by trawling a mile beneath the ocean off the African coast, that exists deep, deep, deep within the ocean, and that very rarely appears above water or close enough to the surface that people get to see it. Could an animal like this be one of these 750,000 undiscovered species, of which there may be some gigantic monsters out there that we have just happened to miss? Nobody ever talks about this. Nobody wants to acknowledge that possibility. Everybody wants to talk about dinosaurs, and they want to talk about how we can debunk this because we can prove to you that dinosaurs do not exist any longer. And if they did, we would have a tremendously terrible understanding of the archaeological, the paleontological record. We don't have to look for dinosaurs. All we have to do is look at the obscure naturalist journals. We need to look at the reports like these of Anton Brun, who dissected this thing. A trained naturalist who identified what he looked at as being nothing but a 6-foot long unidentified eel larva, larger by perhaps orders of magnitude than any known eel larva to exist on planet Earth. How big is mommy and daddy? How big? That's my question to you. And that, my friends, may account for all we know, for the sea monster mystery. The sea serpent that we've all heard about may not be a serpent at all. It actually may be an eel. But we've got to really seriously take into consideration what biology might exist out there.
Yeah, those stories in New Zealand where eels will literally grab cattle off the bank and eat them.
What?
Yeah, you've not heard that?
No, I haven't heard that.
I want to say, I'm pretty sure that would be easy to find. I don't think that was just a story I heard.
Well, either way, I mean, you know, I've been on the giant leptocephalus kick for a long time. But I want to thank again Billy Clark for sending along those three reports from several years ago that talk about other scientists, even skeptical scientists who have said that, well, really, statistically, the likelihood of there being something extremely large out there is pretty good, and we probably haven't found all of them. Folks, I'm going to tell you, it's a gut feeling, but I think at very least at some time, and maybe still today, there are some extremely large things that still exist out there. Now, before we wrap things up, there's a final story Caleb had sent along, and I think that it would be really apt to look at this in concluding today's edition of the Gray Alien Report. And this was essentially a kit of sorts, okay, a baloney detection kit that was discussed by Carl Sagan.
I love baloney.
I love baloney, too, and I love detecting it.
I love fried baloney.
I don't really love bologna, actually. I got to be honest.
You don't. You guys grew up like me. You ate fried bologna. Tell me.
Government meat.
Tyler usually is eating the meat of Hadel babies.
I'll eat any kind of meat if it's fried and has like little holes cut in it to make it look smiley.
Would you eat a gigantic eel meat?
Yeah, actually.
Would you eat human meat? Eel. Human?
Tyler makes necklaces out of bologna rings.
Meat. I wouldn't feel comfortable eating human meat. That's why I don't eat at McDonald's.
Would you drink human? No, never mind. We're just going to stop right there. But
human blood.
Caleb?
You're in trouble.
Oh, God. Both you guys took it to the next level. Caleb had brought this to my attention today and everything. And, of course, this is actually kind of paraphrasing some things that Sagan had said in The Demon-Haunted World. My friend, the astronomy professor at App State University, Dr. Dan Caton, renowned for being a skeptic and renowned for writing in a very dismissive way about UFOs, but I mean, by the same token, Dan studies UFOs in the sense that, and he might cringe a bit hearing me say that, but I think he would agree in that when I say he studies UFOs, he is a proponent of the possibility that there is a natural phenomenon that contributes to what is seen in the Limbo Gorge and what is, you know, known throughout this region and around the world as the mystery of the Brown Mountain Lights.
Yeah, Megla Firefly.
Yes, exactly. And, well, actually, you know, funny enough, I think that my good friend, the retired geologist Ed Spear, does feel that fireflies are part of the equation, and not just typical fireflies, but blue ghost fireflies. And he actually makes a very compelling case for some Brown Mountain Light reports actually being blue ghost fireflies. But again, you know, this is something that a lot of people will be like, yeah, right. Maybe not in every instance, but I'm sure that Ed is correct in saying that people have seen blue ghost fireflies, didn't know what they were seeing, weren't capable of judging proper distance, and thought that they were seeing something strange. Dan Caton, on the other hand, I think still holds to the possibility that there may be some sort of a phenomenon akin to ball lightning occurring, and has worked hard to be able to achieve cameras that are set up throughout the gorge that are capable of monitoring parts of the gorge at hours where people typically would not be active. And so hopefully our goal is to try and capture decent video of some sort of true anomaly, some anomalous light. And there are a lot of lights that appear in the gorge that can't be accounted for, but none of them offer hard scientific evidence of what we think may be going on down there. But anyway, Dan's a great guy, and I remember he told me that during a recent meetup that we, in a group that he's involved with of scientists that are interested in the Brown Mountain Lights, Dan had mentioned that he makes an optional reading. Maybe he actually requires it in certain courses, but he teaches astronomy, of course, at App State, and he says that parts of The Demon-Haunted World by Carl Sagan, he actually asks his students to read. And if you've ever read that book, it's a skeptical scientific argument against most UFO reports, okay? He doesn't go case for case so much as Sagan kind of talks about applying, in a broader sense, scientific understanding to the UFO subject. I think that that's important to do. I also think maybe that Sagan didn't look individually at enough cases to be able to understand maybe that there are some that I do think warrant something a little more exotic than what Sagan, probably at his most imaginative, thought that UFOs could represent. But nonetheless, I think that his contribution, however skeptical it was, even however dismissive of certain data it may have been, I think that we have to recognize that there are valuable contributions in his scientific discernment and his call to people who study UFOs to not become beholden to just faith and belief, but to remember what data and what science can tell us about things. And so, in the book, he discusses basically what he calls a baloney detection kit, a set of cognitive tools and techniques that fortify the mind against the penetration that can occur by falsehoods. And he says the kit is brought out as a matter of course whenever new ideas are offered for consideration. If the new idea survives examination by the tools in our kit, we grant it warm, though tentative, acceptance. If you're so inclined, if you don't want to buy baloney, even when it's measuring, reassuring rather, to you to do so, there are precautions that can be taken. There's a tried and true consumer-tested method. Now, he says it isn't merely a tool of science. Science, rather, it contains invaluable tools of healthy skepticism, but that apply just as elegantly and just as necessarily to everyday life. By adopting the kit, he says, we can all shield ourselves against clueless guile and deliberate manipulation. Here are nine of those tools right now that Caleb provided just before we went to air. One, whenever possible, there must be independent confirmation of what we call facts. Two, encourage substantive data or debate on the evidence by knowledgeable proponents of all points of view. Think about that one right there, guys.
Sorely lacking in today's climate.
Often, yeah, that is the case.
Shout it down.
Yeah. Encourage substantive debate. Encourage substantive debate on the evidence by knowledgeable proponents of all points of view. Think about that. Arguments from authority carry little weight. Authorities have made mistakes in the past. They will do so again in the future. Perhaps a better way to say it is that in science, there are no authorities. At most, there are experts.
Don't let the authorities catch you saying that.
Yeah, exactly. That's something that I like that point.
Well, it reminds me of,
I actually like all of these points so far.
Well, I think that
I feel like they need to be applied today.
Whether or not you're a hardcore believer or a skeptic, I think you're going to find that you'll agree with a lot of these. And that one, last one, reminds me a lot of what was going on during the Bush administration and the present
WMDs.
Administration and the present administration. By the way, anyway, number four: spin more than one hypothesis. If there's something to be explained, think of all the different ways in which it could be explained. Then think of tests by which you might systematically disprove each of the alternatives. We're not in this business, folks, to try and prove. And that's exactly what Sagan says. Try and create ways that one might systematically disprove each of the alternatives. Remember what Holmes said. Sherlock Holmes, the fictional character. But he said, you've got to be able to eliminate all that is completely implausible. And once you've removed all that is implausible, that which remains, which cannot be eliminated, is what must be taken as fact. What survives, Sagan says, the hypothesis that resists disproof in this Darwinian selection among multiple working hypotheses has a much better chance of being the right answer than if you had simply run with the first idea that caught your fancy. Number five, try not to get overtly attached to a hypothesis just because it's yours.
Oh, that one really hurts for big industrial giants, you know, the one that makes them the most money they're pretty attached to. So.
But, you know, when you look at people who, you know, for instance, have been proponents of there's something happening at Roswell, New Mexico, I'm sorry, I think most of the overwhelming evidence points away from there being anything that ever happened at Roswell of significance, but many of the people who have been proponents of that over the years will not step down off of that position. I commend one of the best ufologists alive today, Kevin Randall, for being a person who has said, you know, as I get older, the more I look at it, really, I was once an advocate of the Roswell mystery. You know, after really, really, really reviewing the evidence and the testimony, I doubt that exactly what we once thought happened there is what happened. And if anything, probably very little in relation to real UFOs took place there. Number six, quantify. If whatever it is you're explaining has some measure, some numerical quantity attached to it, you'll be much better able to discriminate among competing hypotheses. What is vague and qualitative is open to many explanations. Of course, there are truths to be sought in the many qualitative issues we are obliged to confront, but finding them is more challenging. Number seven, if there's a chain of argument, every link in the chain must work, including the premise, not just most of them. Number eight, Occam's razor. The convenient rule of thumb urges us when faced with two hypotheses that explain the data equally well, you should choose the simpler. And nine, always ask whether the hypothesis can be, at least in principle, falsified. That again, always ask whether the premise, or the hypothesis rather, at very least in principle, can be falsified. Propositions that are untestable, unfalsifiable, are not worth much. Consider the grand idea that our universe and everything in it is just an elementary particle, an electron, say, in a much bigger cosmos. But if we can never acquire information from outside our universe, is not the idea incapable of disproof. You must be able to check assertions out. Inveterate skeptics must be given the chance to allow your reasoning, or follow it, and to duplicate your experiments and see if they get the same result. Folks, we'll continue forever if we have to, trying to find the results that bring us the truth. And that's what we seek to do every week on this program that we call The Graylian Report. Gentlemen, Caleb and Tyler, thank you again for joining me. It's always a pleasure to be in here with you. Your minds are brilliant, bright. So much so that you illuminate the bunker. On behalf of all of us here, in fact, Caleb Hanks, Tyler Pittman, Matthew Oakley, John Anderson, Dick Oakley, and yours truly, Micah Hanks, the mouth of the South, we hope that your week has been enlightening just as well. Greatly next subscribers, we'll talk to you again later this week, and the rest of you, we'll talk to you Monday night on the KGRA. It is the Micah Hanks radio program then. This has been the Graylian Report. And I'm your mouth of the South, Micah Hanks. Talk to you again soon, and stay strange.
You've been listening to The Graylian Report with Micah Hanks. Any rebroadcast or duplication of this program or program content without express written permission is strictly prohibited. The Graylian Report, in direct cooperation with the internet website graylianreport.com.